Accession number 286.85, Mr. George Mail, Reel 3. Now, how did things change when you moved into the sick bay, across the road? I presume things started to move a little more.
Purposely. Yes. We were now getting various cases from the new entries and from the regular staff. It could be anything.
What type of cases?
Oh, injuries, people falling over, hurting themselves, people with appendicitis. We have one interesting case. Peter Bull, who had been he ran the little theatre at Perranporth before the war. He was a professional actor, a big chap. You probably have seen him in films because he was in a lot of films after the war. Well, Peter was brought in with tonsillitis, and we had to do T&A, tonsils and adenoids.
Cut them out.
Yeah. Consequently, he got a very sore throat, which happens after tonsillectomy. He got an aunt. He was from a rich family. He'd got an aunt in London who used to send him parcels of food from Fortnum and Mason's. Now, how Fortnum and Mason's got able to provide this sort of thing in a war, I don't know, but Peter got these parcels, and there'd be beautiful Dundee cakes with almonds on and various other goodies. And poor Peter was there in bed, unable to eat these things. He could only have ice cream and soft food. So we used to help him. And Peter was kept in the sick quarters longer than anybody had ever been ill because these parcels arrived. There could only have been two or three, I should think, during his period. But that was a notable case. Another interesting case, one Sunday afternoon, I was sat in the office at the sick quarters, and a lad came in from Fisgard, and he got his hands in front of him. He was holding his left thumb in his right fist, and we were always known as Doc. The doctors were known as the Quack. Doc, can you put this back for me? And he pulled his hand and he got his thumb, his left thumb in his right fist, and there was the way it had come off. Can you put this back for me, Doc? And what had happened, he'd done his 4 years training as an artificer for the Navy, and it was a quiet weekend. He was making himself a tool chest to take his tools when he was going on draft, and he was pushing a bulk of timber through a rotary saw, and his thumb went one side. Well, today you might attempt to put a thumb back, but in those days all you could do was put the thumb in the bucket and tidy up the wound. It meant that he'd lost his profession. Without an opposing thumb, he couldn't hold tools. So he had to retrain. I don't know what happened, but he couldn't be an artificer. And that was very sad. While I was there, we had the blitzes on Plymouth.
Now, tell me about that, because that was quite a severe series of air raids, wasn't it?
On one night, we were only a couple of miles outside Plymouth. So we were involved in when the planes came over. They came over us as well as over the city. On one occasion, one night, Stanley Smallshaw, one of these St. John ambulance chaps who was a sick bed there, we were out in the dark looking up, and we could see this plane caught in the searchlights. And Stanley Smallshaw said, Eee, I could have got that bugger with tear syringe. Something not so funny, on one occasion that an HE dropped between two of the wooden huts on Raleigh, and the huts, all the trainees had to leave their wooden huts and go in between each two huts. There was a brick-built air raid shelter, a long shelter with concrete slab roofs and then all covered over with earth. And an HE dropped on one of those and 72 bodies were taken out. One night...
Now, were you involved in that? I mean, as a secret...
I didn't have to go down, fortunately, and deal with that. Others did, other sick birth staff. The routine at night was, if there was a red alert, if there was an air raid, any patients who were in their beds would be taken on stretchers, because the wards were wooden. The only permanent building was a decontamination block, and that was built of 18-inch thick brickwork with slab roofs. So we'd take them. Why they weren't taken over as a routine, I don't know, because we had raids night after night. But as soon as a raid started, you'd have to take all the patients into the block, and then it was the job of the night duty staff to erect fire extinguishers, fire hydrants around the outside of the block. By this time, I was made a leading hand, and I was in charge of two sick birth staff with me on this night. And the routine was that the fire hydrant would be dealt with outside the surgical block first, but diagonally opposite the surgical block was the operating theatre, my particular requirement. So I decided on this night that we would go to the operating block, go outside the operating block, and put the hydrant there. There were three of us. Bob Humphreys was one, I can't remember the third one, but there were three of us around this 24 by 18 inch manhole cover, which we had to lift off. Remember, it's blackout, you mustn't use any light to show anything, you're there in the dark, and you've got this pit in front of you where you had to fix a standpipe. And the three of us were around this hole and trying to fit this standpipe. And we could hear, there was a lot of noise going on, and we could hear a plane approaching, and it was quite common that they would drop a stick of eight bombs one after the other. We could hear them coming closer, and as it got very close, the three of us, tin hats on of course, stuck our heads down this 24 by 18 manhole, and we got stuck. We had to take our tin hats off before we could get our heads out. When we got out, we found that the sick quarters had been wrecked. This last bomb had dropped where the hydrant outside the surgical block was. So we had a narrow escape that night. We got in, the roof was off most of the sick quarters. Windows had all been, the place was wrecked. I got to the surgical ward. Windows are gone, most of the roof was gone, some of the girders were still there, and we had big white globes over the lights down the middle, and one of them was still there, unbroken, and I'd got a broom in my hand to doing a bit of clearing up, and I saw this globe. I whacked it and broke this globe, stupidest thing. But that was experiences over there.
Now, anything else? Any other training or anything else happening while you're at...
Yeah, we were doing classes then. I'd already done classes in order to qualify to become a leading hand, a clerk.
Now, Tom, what difference did it make being a leading hand?
Meant you got a bit more money, a few pence extra a day, and you got some authority, and you were got further responsibilities.
Now, what did you have to learn? How did you qualify to be promoted to that?
Mostly learning what was in the sick birth manual. It was all there. You had to absorb all different diseases and treatments for them. And the instructions were there for a sick birth attendant who was on a ship on his own and perhaps had to do an appendix. So the basics were there for all likely things that you would encounter. It wasn't very difficult. I got the Killix, got through, got the Killix badge.
I didn't think I was going on a rally.
Yeah, 1941, summertime, early summer. The dates are in my folder there somewhere. 10:30 on Saturday morning, I'm in the theatre and I'm making sure everything is Bristol fashion, ship shape, because at 12 o'clock I'm going on 7 days leave. It's now 10:30. A sick bayman came up to me in the theatre. "You're on draft. The warrant wardmaster wants to see you." Oh yeah, okay. I took no notice. I mean, it's just the sort of nonsense you get when they know you're going on leave in an hour and a half. 10 minutes later, the chief comes up. "Warrant wardmaster's doing his nut. Why aren't you in his office?" "Chief, I thought it was a bloody skylark." "No skylark," he says. "You'd better get down there quick." So I'm given an hour, just over an hour, to pack up all my kit, and kit bag, and hammock, and get ready for a truck to take me from HMS Raleigh at Tor Point across the ferry and to HMS Drake. Well, we got there about 1 o'clock, and as happens on a Saturday in the Navy, either people are watch ashore and gone, or the watch aboard have had their tot, they've had their dinner, and in naval parlance, they've crashed. They're having a kip. So there was nobody about. I went to the sick quarters, dropped my kit bag and hammock, and went up and walked out the gate. Went home for the weekend, went in on Monday. I was in the barracks for nearly a fortnight.
And do you know what month this is in summer, roughly?
I think it's in June, I think.
That makes sense.
The dates are in my records there. I was there certainly longer than my 7 days leave, which didn't happen. And then I was told, to go to the drafting office. I was given a railway warrant and 2 meal vouchers for 2 shillings each, and told to report to St. Enoch's Hotel, Glasgow, which was the drafting office in Scotland. So I go off by myself, having not had my leave, and I get to St. Enoch's Hotel, and this great big room, and a chief came to the desk, and I'd got this paper with me. "Where's HMS Hecla? Anybody know anything about a ship called Hecla?" "No, chief, not a bloody clue." "No." So he said to me, "Well, you better go down to Greenock and report there." So I go to Greenock. And down there, they gave me money to get accommodation ashore and wait for further instructions. I was down at Greenock for a week or more, and then I was put aboard the Royal Ulsterman. It was a small ship that used to ply between Scotland and Northern Ireland, taking passengers. And when I got aboard the Royal Ulsterman, I was the only naval person there. She was crewed by merchant seamen who'd been on her in peacetime, I suppose. There were a few soldiers and a few airmen, but I was the only naval person. I found a sick bay. There was a cot there. And there was no doctor on the ship. It was only a small ship. So I took over the sick bay because there was a bed there that I could use. And when we sailed, these army and air force types came along to me, seasick. What can I do about seasick? So you can do the same as I do. I was sick as well. Just have a dry biscuit and keep walking around the deck. It took a couple of days to get up to Iceland. And we go into Valfjord, which was being used as a naval base. It was 40 miles from the entrance to the loch up to the end where the ships were gathered. Amongst the ships that were there was this HMS Hecla. Instead of putting me on a boat and taking me across there, this boat that I was on, they refueled, went out to sea again, and 40 miles round to Reykjavik. And I was put ashore there. There they called there was a big warehouse where salt cod was stored. It was common food in those days. They used to call it torag, this salt cod. Well, there was no fish there because it had all been cleared out. But they renamed it HMS Balder. And the night that I was there, I had to sling a hammock. It was the first night and the only night that I ever slept in a hammock in my 6 years in the Navy. The next day, I was put aboard a little fishing boat and taken out to sea and around to Hecla, the beginning of my seafaring.
And what month would this be, July?
June or July, yeah.
In that area, you're not quite sure.
When I got aboard the Hecla, she was a brand new ship built on the Clyde to Lloyd's pre-war standard. She was beautiful.
Can you describe her? Because I know there's pictures of her and things, but can you sort of give us an outline of what she was like?
Well, to me, she was huge. She was nearly 11,000 tons. She was a destroyer depot ship. Destroyer, corvette, and submarines. We had every facility required to keep these small ships at sea, irrespective of any shore facilities. We weren't very popular in Iceland because if a destroyer came alongside and had to do a boiler clean, it could be done there, or we could take out parts of main engines. We could do all sorts of things that were required to keep the ships going. If we weren't there, they would have gone back to Northern Ireland or Glasgow or some other port and perhaps got some shore leave. But instead of that, they had to kick their heels tied up alongside us.
She was known as what? A depot ship? What was your reception when you joined? How did you come aboard? It's a new ship. It's your first big ship.
Two doctors. The senior one CDW Kit Kat, Lieutenant Commander. He laughed when he saw me. He said, I've been sending signals to Admiralty for 5 months for a surgical specialist. And they've sent you. Well, I shouldn't bother to unpack too much. We've already got an operating technician. I reckon you'll be aboard about 3 weeks. Well, I was still on the ship when she sank 2 years later. Our sick quarters, we'd got a main sick bay with 22 cots.
Now, can you describe the sick bay? How was it laid out? What did it look like physically and every other way you can think of?
Well, we've got better facilities than the average cottage hospital. As you approached the sick bay, which was on the on the first deck, not the upper deck, the one below, there was two cabins in which there were four cots in each for sick bay. Then there was the medical officer's office with desks for the two doctors. Then you came into the main sick bay. 22 cots, twin cots. Each cot had rails at the side about 9 inches high, which could be taken off, and a tray balanced on these rails that would move along, a tray with a box arrangement underneath and a space to take a cup so that it wouldn't spill. And on the other side, there was a sluice room and a room where any sailors who'd got up to something ashore that they shouldn't and needed to take some precaution, they could come in there, having been ashore, and use there was a big thing of Condy's fluid kept with a...
What is Condy's fluid? I mean, they always talk about it. I don't know whether they still use it.
It's a purple disinfectant.
That was the main treatment, was it?
They could
prophylactic treatment.
Push that up their urethra in the hope that if they caught something, this might deal with it. Then there was the bathroom.
Hang on, what was the sluice room? What was that for? What went on in there?
We used to use it for our dobying, that's washing. I can't think much what the sluice room was used for.
What was in there?
A couple of deep troughs with hot and cold water, some cupboards in which stuff could be kept, cleaning materials and that sort of thing. That was the sluice room.
So, and then the bathroom you mentioned?
The bathroom had got two baths. There were no showers in those days, but two big baths and two wash basins, hot and cold. And then beyond that was the dispensary, which got all the necessary equipment. Then beyond that was the operating theatre, which had got an operating table in it, a fairly basic type of table.
What else was it?
Movable tables for putting our instruments on, and dressings and so forth. And there were two big cupboards and shelves at the sides. And the operating lights was a series of 12 lights on a bracket up above where the operating theatre was. Didn't have a proper operating lamp. We got all we needed in the theatre. And then beyond the main bay, there was a six-bed cabin, which we used as our mess. Quite against Admiralty regulations, the chief petty officer, the petty officer, leading hands, and the sick berth staff all messed together, and we got on very well.
Now, what was the sick bay mess like then?
They got these six beds in there, six cots in frames. Each cot was suspended from the bulkhead above to the ground on two poles, one at the head, one at the foot, and the cots were secured by a U fitting which went to the bolt. If you lifted that up and it could be clipped up, then the cot could swing. So if the ship was rolling, you were at sea, you could keep on an even keel, as it were.
When you met, tell us a bit about the characters then. Who were these doctors? I mean, what were their names again?
C.W. Kitcat, Surgeon Lieutenant Commander.
How do you spell that, his name?
C.D.E., capital W, K.I.T.C.A.T., Kitcat. He'd been a GP in London.
What was he like?
He played the guitar. he was very good. He was a very efficient man. I suppose he was in his 40s. The junior doctor, Stephen Hetherington, surgeon lieutenant, as I say, he was straight out of medical school, I'm sure. That was why they wanted a surgical specialist, because he had to do the operations, and he was good, but it was obvious that he hadn't got a lot of experience.
And how did you get on with these doctors?
Very well indeed, particularly Steve Hetherington, the young doc. He and the schoolmaster, who was Gregory Clark, the youngest officer aboard, the two of them would spend a lot of time with us in our mess in the sick bay. We were very fond of playing cards. Bezique was the main card game we played, and chess. And they would spend, particularly in the tropics, they would have their dinner with us rather than have it in the wardroom, because they didn't like to have to change from tropical shorts and shirt in order to be formally dressed in the wardroom.
Now, who else was part of your team?
The chief petty officer, who was Norman Brown. He was short.
And what was...
He would have been retired, but he had to stay on in the Navy, as others did. He was marvellous. He was very good at X-rays, and he was a very good amateur photographer. He spent a lot of time trying to make an enlarger for photographs, because it was all black and white stuff at the time.
And what was his role meant to be as chief petty officer within the sick bay?
To make sure the medical officers had got what they wanted, to chase us up if we needed it, and to do the radiography.
Now, how did you get... You got on well with him, from the sound of it.
Oh, yeah, he was a great chap. Great chap. Little fella. But he was good. He looked after us well. Then there was a petty officer, Bastable, who later became commissioned and retired as a lieutenant commander, which was about as high as you could get in our department.
And what was he like?
He was a friend of mine. We used to go ashore together, three of us, Bernard, who was my particular friend, who was another leading hand. Bernard Shaw, his actual name was Brian Shaw, but everybody got nicknames. In the as soon as I got aboard the Hecla, Bernard said, oh, we've already got a George. You'll be Spike. So I was always known as Spike Male aboard the ship.
And why Spike?
Just because I was tall and thin. That's all.
And everyone had nicknames, did they?
Nearly everybody, yeah.
Not too derogatory from the sound of it.
No.
Just friendly names.
That's right, yeah.